Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
Governor Andrew Cuomo signed a bill into law this week that further decriminalizes marijuana possession in New York. The law ends criminal prosecution for possession of up to 2 ounces of cannabis, and the action came on a day when the governor also signed new gun control measures into law. The Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt reports.
Under the law, possession of up to 1 ounce of the drug would be punishable by a $50 fine. Having up to 2 ounces of cannabis would bring a $200 fine. The measure also creates a mechanism to expunge the records for some past marijuana convictions. Emma Goodman with the Legal Aid Society of New York says the measure is a step forward. She says it helps communities of color that have been disproportionately targeted by the state's marijuana laws, but she says it also falls short.
I don't think it's going to make a big enough difference. I do think that people that have been harmed by the era of broken windows policing will be somewhat affected by it in a positive way, because there are people that have a bunch of low-level marijuana convictions that they won't have anymore.
Melissa Moore with the Drug Policy Alliance says the new law does not go far enough to address what she says are the collateral consequences of decades of marijuana criminalization. And she says the new law does not prohibit police from making arrests if they catch someone possessing marijuana.
They can continue to face parole and probation violations for marijuana. They can keep being separated from their children in ways that are very problematic over a low-level arrest, where there's no sort of documentation or any sort of indication of harm. And people can still continue to face immigration consequences for marijuana arrests, which is, you know, a huge concern in this moment.
The Drug Policy Alliance, Legal Aid Society, and other advocates say they will continue to press lawmakers to legalize the adult use of recreational marijuana. They were unable to get enough votes in the state Senate for passage. But Moore with the Drug Policy Alliance says polls show support among New Yorkers for legalization, and she hopes to have more success in the 2020 legislative session.
It's an incredibly popular issue across the state, and even in, you know, some of the battleground areas that, you know, members had a lot of concerns about when we did polling in their districts, we actually found that people who were likely 2020 voters in those demographics, in those districts, were actually more likely to support a candidate that had supported marijuana regulation. So, you know, I think absolutely we'll be back.
Cuomo also signed gun control measures approved by the legislature last January. One requires a 30-day waiting period for a gun sale if the purchaser is flagged in an initial background check. The Senate sponsor of the measure, Senate Deputy Majority Leader Michael Gianaris, spoke on the floor when the bill was passed.
The FBI itself says on average it takes about 20 to 25 days for a background check that has been flagged to be completed. And this is the most common sense of common sense proposals.
Another measure outlaws the possession and transport of so-called bump stocks, devices that further accelerate the speed of semi-automatic weapons and that have been used in prior mass shootings. The action comes one day after a shooting at a California food festival killed 3 people, including a 6-year-old boy and a 13-year-old girl. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Interesting conversation you had this week with Senator Liz Krueger. She's from the east side of Manhattan, and she's been really working for a long time on the legalization of marijuana. Now, the legislature this year did not pass that for recreational use. They did further decriminalize marijuana. Perhaps one of the most interesting things she said to you was that she felt that the governor had told his people to walk away from the final negotiations.
Well, that's right. Look, the governor has been obfuscational, for a better word, about how all of this came about. He blames the Senate Democrats, but really, it's nonsense. She was ready to go from day one. She was ready to go and put it in the budget. She was ready to do a separate thing with the governor. who had signaled. There's no question about it from the very beginning that he was not in favor of this. And then when politics moved left, he moved left. But, you know, he's always blamed the Senate Republicans. Now that they're out of office, the same game is on. He's blaming the Senate Democrats. They're looking up in shock and saying, what, us? You know, the thing I love about Liz Krueger is she tells the truth, always has. She made it clear in my conversation with her that this is on the governor. So we'll see. They did some things, decriminalization, other things with it, with the marijuana, but they didn't make it legal. And it takes a gutsy person, and in this case, Liz Krueger, to call it like it is.
And she seemed fairly confident that they would be moving forward this legalization through the next session.
Well, I teased her, as I always tease the governor about this, and said, hey, my little small town of Great Barrington had $1 million extra dollars. From New Yorkers and others,
right,
who came across that border. And she acknowledged it. She said, yes, that should be money that should go to the citizens of New York. And David, one thing that she did say, and I think is exactly right, is at least if you legalize, you take it out of the hands of the criminal elements and you give it back to the taxpayers.
Perhaps the more interesting political discussion you had with Senator Krueger was what seems to be this ongoing fight between the governor and the state Senate.
Well, that is the premise I started our program and our conversation with, and she did not deny it. When it came to a discussion over who lost Amazon, she was quite clear that Amazon is pouring resources into New York right now. I know that the Senate Democrats were very much on the defensive on that issue. And she was already basically saying Amazon's here, they're putting a lot of money into it. All the other space that was supposed to go to Amazon in Long Island City has been rented and is doing quite well. So I still think that's one place that the Senate Democrats have a vulnerability.
Meanwhile, a blockbuster article in the New York Times this week that has to do with, well, I'll read you the headline. A luxury box at Citi Field, an MTA contract, and $188,000 for Governor Andrew Cuomo. The subhead, Governor Andrew Cuomo attacks the Metropolitan Transportation Authority contractors for profiting from the agency, but he relies on some of the same firms for major campaign cash. This has to do with the Howland Group, which had wanted to expand into the lucrative world of contracting with the Metropolitan Transportation Authority, the agency that oversaw the subway and is controlled by Mr. Cuomo, and they got a $23 million contract for cleaning the drains in the subways.
David, this governor has been fierce in his denial of taking money in a pay-to-play scheme. He has said he doesn't even know these people in the past, but on the other hand, he collects great deals of money for his campaigns. And in this case, the Times has done a good job of reporting that there seems to be a relationship between the people who are giving the money and getting the contracts. Did he know about it? That's the issue. Because unless somebody engages in a quid pro quo, they can't be found to be wanting. He says no, but facts are facts. And people who give the money seem to be getting the rewards.
Will the system of campaign financing change in New York?
Well, it should. There should be a prohibition, David, against anybody getting a contract who gives money to a campaign. Other states have it. It should be the case here in New York. The fact that the legislature and the governor won't do it indicates that they would not be happy with the results.
The issue of immigration is often considered along the borders and the ports. But right here in the capital region of New York, we have a story about activists who gathered this week, Alan, in our program in Rensselaer County, where the Department of Motor Vehicles is housed, to protest county plans to share residents' personal information with ICE.
Well, yeah, you look, New York doesn't like Trump. New York doesn't like ICE. And you don't have to know more than that. And every time there is a sense of cooperation on the part of law enforcement or others with ICE, and people are losing their neighbors or potentially losing their neighbors, and people have been in their communities for years and years, and a black car pulls up, throws somebody in the back seat, and you don't see them again. This is stuff that New Yorkers understand, because most New Yorkers and most people in the country came from other places. If they didn't come, their grandparents came, and we know it.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. You're listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Environmental groups are urging the New York State Department of Health to lower recommended levels for three drinking water contaminants. A public comment period on the recommendations for PFOA and PFOS is now open. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn has more.
The State Drinking Water Quality Council in December recommended maximum contaminant levels for three chemicals: 10 parts per trillion for PFOA and PFOS, emerging contaminants found in Hoosick Falls and Newburgh, respectively. The council also voted to recommend an MCL of 1 part per billion for 1,4-dioxane. State health officials say the recommendations used the best available science. Environmental Advocates of New York Senior Director for Clean Water Maureen Cunningham contends these numbers are not low enough.
Most notably by the NRDC, saying that basically the goal should be zero. So the maximum contaminant level goal should be zero because that's the most protective of human health.
The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has an advisory level for PFOA and PFOS of 70 parts per trillion each. State and local officials gathered in front of the city of Newburgh's water filtration plant in early July to urge the State Department of Health to implement drinking water standards and begin the regulatory process by publishing the recommended MCLs for public comment. The state announced such intentions days later. The public comment period opened July 24th and closes September 23rd. At the Newburgh gathering, New York Public Interest Research Group Environmental Policy Director Liz Moran called on the state to go further.
New York State has every tool in its power to use to stop this from happening, to stop future water contamination crises, and to ensure that the public knows what's in their water. It starts with setting maximum contaminant levels that are stringent and the most protective of public health and the environment.
Ofra Wolf is a City of Newburgh resident and member of the Newburgh Clean Water Project. She too spoke in Newburgh in early July.
Regulate the entire family of chemicals, and New York State has to regulate them, as Maureen Cunningham said, at the lowest level that science has told us, which is even lower than the state recommendations right now.
With the comment period now open, Wolf says the Department of Health has a statutory and moral obligation to suggest contaminant limits that are supported by current science. A State Department of Health spokeswoman says in part, quote, "The experts on New York's Drinking Water Quality Council recommended the nation's most protective levels for PFOA and PFOS and the first ever level for 1,4-dioxane," end quote. She says the department will take all comments submitted during the 60-day public comment period into consideration. Again, NYPERG's Moran.
But the sad reality is that Newburgh is not alone. New Windsor is not alone. Hoosick Falls is not alone. There are millions of New Yorkers who are already impacted by PFOA, by PFOS, and 1,4-dioxane. And then these are just three chemicals. We found that over 1.4 million New Yorkers are exposed to unsafe levels of PFOA and PFOS, and over 2.8 million New Yorkers are exposed to unsafe levels of 1,4-dioxane. And that's just with limited testing.
Testing, she says, of large water systems. In May, NYPERG issued a report called "What's in My Water?" showing the prevalence of emerging contaminants detected in the state's public drinking water supplies. Meantime, environmental advocate Sullivan says her group is preparing comments and will submit comments both on its own and as part of a coalition, and will continue advocating that the state regulate other PFAS chemicals.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Activists gathered this week outside the Rensselaer County building where the Department of Motor Vehicles is housed to protest county plans to share residents' personal information with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
Civil voting rights and community organizations, including the New York Immigration Coalition and Citizen Action of New York, say they filed a lawsuit Friday to block the County Board of Elections from sharing residents' personal information with U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement when they register to vote. Marinda Galindo is counsel for DEMOS, a public policy and advocacy organization.
On July 18th, Rensselaer County announced that, effective immediately, it would transmit to ICE the personal information of all residents who register to vote at the DMV. Under this plan, county residents with U.S. citizenship are threatened with ICE investigation as the price of registering to vote at the DMV.
Republican Frank Merola is the county clerk.
All we're turning over is names of anybody that registers a vote within New York State that lives in Rensselaer County. We're turning them over to ICE to let them take a look to make sure that they are legal voters and they are here legally. That's all it is.
Galindo says the county policy intimidates voters and violates federal and state laws prohibiting disclosure of sensitive photo registration information. Vanessa Agudelo is manager of member engagement for the Hudson Valley at the New York Immigration Coalition.
Rensselaer County is pulling a page from the Trump playbook by intimidating new citizens from exercising their right to vote and ultimately undermining our democracy simply for political gain. This is yet one of a long series of assaults and attacks against immigrants and communities of color designed to keep them from becoming full participants in our democracy.
Brian McCormick is with the Columbia County Sanctuary Movement. He cited the county sheriff's cooperation with ICE investigations.
We stand on the soil of the only county in the state of New York who has a 287G agreement with ICE, with a county clerk who is against driver's licenses and has threatened to hang a We Call ICE banner outside of this very DMV.
Ceci Alfonso, immigration legal education advocate with Citizen Action, is a resident of Rensselaer County. She warns government officials, don't scare people, don't be unjust to them, and don't give ICE any information.
America is peppered with attempts to stop people who look like me and people who speak Español, como yo, know that we've been intimidated. This is nothing new. But I tell you that I and the people behind me and most Americans know that we have fought in the past and we will continue to fight. We will fight against this anti-racist, anti-immigration, anti-voting policy. We will not stop. And I have to say, we will take the system on legally and we will exercise our right to protest.
In response to the rally, Rensselaer County issued a statement which says, in part, the county has not been served with a complaint, as with any civil proceeding against the county. If and when the county is served, the county will assess the merit or lack of merit of the allegations and act accordingly at the appropriate time. With that said, the County Board of Elections remains committed to fulfilling its legal obligations, including publishing voter names and addresses.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. There are VA medical centers across New York State which serve the needs of veterans. And in Albany, the Stratton VA Medical Center has just opened a new simulation and learning center. The Legislative Gazette's Jesse King was there and filed this report.
The lab at Building 67 is the product of 7 months of work. With several task trainers and five mannequins of ranging fidelity, Medical Center Director Darlene Delancey says the lab helps the VA achieve its objectives as a high-reliability organization.
When I look at this, it is really helping our efforts and to lead our efforts in providing the appropriate health care needed. And what it does, it maximizes our safety, it minimizes our harm, and delivering exceptional care. And it helps us to become a learning organization.
Hello!
The star of the show is Simman 3G, a programmable, high-fidelity mannequin with realistic heart, lung, and bowel sounds, as well as a traceable pulse. As clinical educator Carol Noriega demonstrates, Simman can walk students through scenarios from blood pressure and IV training to CPR and injections.
Uh-oh. What's happening? My oxygen saturation level is dropping. See the value changing on the patient monitor? Look at my mouth. I'm becoming cyanotic. And I'm also breathing faster. When this happens, I hope you'll take quick action to save me.
When Simman says he's cyanotic, he's not kidding. He really does turn blue to simulate a lack of oxygen in the body. Noriega says Simman has a wide range of physiological and neurological responses to the care he receives. She says Simman can sweat, gasp for air, cough, and respond to more than 145 drugs. And while Noriega admits these reactions can catch students off guard, they ultimately give students a realistic experience in a safe space. With a two-way mirror in the lab, Noriega can observe students from another room and communicate via Simman's speaker system.
And what's unique about that is as the learner is experiencing the scenario, I'm able to make changes back here without them seeing that I make a change, so they can't anticipate seeing something happen.
Noriega says the entire simulation and learning center, Simman and all, came together with a $5,000 budget. Considering some hospital beds alone cost that much, designated learning officer Patricia Muster says the team had to be creative.
And so what we did was we looked around the hospital to see what kind of extra equipment was available. And there's also something called an extra equipment list. So for example, the beds that we got, they were available somewhere within the VA system, so all we had to pay was for the freight to ship them here.
Noriega says she plans to research grants to develop the lab even further. Of course, the center will largely be used by VA staff, but Muster says she'd like to get the larger community involved too. Noriega says the lab is designed to train anyone caring for veterans.
Anywhere from housekeeping, they can come in here and learn how to clean a bed with a patient in it. Even learn how to clean a room, a terminal clean, because it's different than just standard housekeeping. We can have dietary come in. We can have police come in and talk about a disruptive patient. Nursing assistants who have never given a bath before, we can actually practice on that. And we can go all the way up to the physician level. So it's everybody.
Reporting from Albany, I'm Jesse King.
Hey, Jesse from WAMC. I'm so glad you could make it today. Thank you so much.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. The record high water levels in Lake Ontario this year are not just flooding shoreline communities. They're also permanently changing the landscape by accelerating erosion. As the Innovation Trail's Payne Horning reports, one community in Oswego County is joining together to rebuild some of what's been lost.
Both in appearance and function, the sand dunes in North Sandy Pond are best described as two gates. These narrow 3.5-mile-long strips of land separate the pond from the lake, and through a small channel in between the north and south dunes, water from the lake is able to trickle in, but the powerful waves are kept out. Local resident Ron Fisher says that balance is why this community that grew along the shore of Sandy Pond has thrived for so long.
They're not really built for being lake homes. They're built for being on a pond, which normally stays quite peaceful, and the wave action is dampened by that barrier beach. We depend on that. That's really the lifeblood for us, is having the barrier beach there and intact.
But these days, this gate has more than one opening. As water levels went up in 2017 and again this year, the waves wiped away much of the beach on the side of the north dune that faces the lake. And the lake has now swelled to a point that its waves have punched holes in at least four spots in this dune. On a recent trip to see the damage, Fisher gets out of the boat in green waist-high boots to measure how deep the water is in one of the openings.
What do you got there?
Still a good 2 feet. Wow. Still about 2 feet.
Greenpoint homeowner Mike Garland says he remembers when you used to have to climb over a hill of sand in this very spot just to see the lake. Now the only thing standing between the pond and the lake here are the few remaining trees that once sat atop the dune.
And the stronger the west wind, the bigger the waves, the bigger the hole will get. They'll just keep washing it out.
bit by bit.
Kathy Goodenough, owner of the Greenpoint Marina on Sandy Pond, has experienced devastating flooding at her business and seen many homeowners here forced to leave because of the water levels.
Sandy Pond hosts some of the best beaches in tourism, and we get a lot of people here, and a lot of businesses rely on this. It's not just marinas. It's every little mom and pop, a grocery store, the bars, restaurants. Everybody relies on these people to come to their summer residence. And as you can see, we don't have that.
The destruction of the dunes also presents a threat to local wildlife. The piping plover, an endangered species in the Great Lakes, uses the dunes' beaches to nest. But much of it has been stripped away by the lake and dropped into Sandy Pond. Researcher Tom Hart says one way to potentially stop this damage is by reversing it.
It's a matter of taking the sand that's been deposited and moving it back to where it came from and restore the shoreline to 2011 levels.
Hart is leading the North Sandy Pond Resiliency Project, a nature-based attempt to fix the problem. It has support from local landowners, the town of Sandy Creek, and New York State. Together, they've raised $500,000 to fund the relocation of sand from the bottom of the pond through hydraulic dredging into long mesh-like bags called geotubes. Once water levels go down this fall, those bags will be laid along what remains of the beach on the North Sand Dune. After all of the water has drained from the tubes, they will be broken open and the reconstruction of the beach can begin. Fisher says it's a huge undertaking that's never been attempted here before, and there's no guarantee it will even work. But the stakes are too high not to act.
People have their whole lives invested in properties and businesses and everything else happening around here that we need to make sure are protected and taken care of.
That's the Innovation Trail's Payne Horning reporting. And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 1931. Or just listen to our podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina.